I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today I'm talking to Manu Samnotra, assistant professor in the School of International and Global Studies at the University of South Florida. We're discussing his 2020 book, Worldly Shame, Ethos in Action, from Lexington Press. Samnotra works on 20th century political thought, especially the theories of Hannah Arendt, Heidegger, and Gandhi, and has written several articles on these topics. Manu Samnotra, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you, Jeff. I want to say that I've been a long-time listener, first-time caller. I know this is not that kind of show, but I'm very excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
We could make it that type of show. I'll get some callers in for you, Manu. Don't tempt me. Good. Well, I love the book. It's a great book. It's about shame and the thought of Hannah Arendt, two topics that I like to think about, and you bring them together in a really interesting way here. Can you begin by talking about the motivation for writing the book?
Right. Thank you for that question. I think it's a really helpful question. And every time I listen to the other sort of guests that you've had, and I listen to what they have to say about that, it's always very enlightening to me to see how autobiographical, scholarly, and political concerns often braid themselves into, the motivations that someone brings to a book. And if I can sort of unbraid them in my case, the story would go something like this. Intellectually, I think I first encountered Arendt as a 22-year-old when I first went to the New School to do my MA. And there, everybody, as you can imagine, was talking about Arendt. Arendt looms very large at that institution. And although I think I'd probably heard of her name, I know for a fact that I had not read anything by her. And so I asked one of my friends to recommend a book, and he said, I guess in hindsight, maybe he threw too much at me. He said, start with The Human Condition. Now, subsequently, I've met lots of people who've read Arendt, including those who don't like her. But everybody agrees that when you first read The Human Condition, you are sort of taken along by the text, the majesty of what she's saying, the breadth of vision that she brings to it. And I remember being very impressed as a 22-year-old reading The Human Condition, not understanding, of course, much, much, much of the book. I dare say I still don't understand much of it. But back then it was even worse. And I wish I'd been a more attentive reader back then, because at the end of reading the book, I was left with the feeling that this is something truly amazing. It's an amazing instrument. I don't know what it's for. I don't know what the politics I can get out of it is. Perhaps it's an unfair question to ask of The Human Condition, but that's where I was coming from. And then I read On Revolution and Eichmann in Jerusalem and Life of the Mind and Between Past and Future and the other sort of texts that people say are part of Arendt's, body of work that makes her such a distinctive writer in the history of political thought. All of it was very impressive. All of it was ultimately politically sterile. I couldn't quite understand why it was important. And that has partly to do with an autobiographical interest of mine or a concern of mine, what the kinds of energies I was bringing to the table were. And principally, those energies were of a young man from India and Kenya who had come to the US and had thought that he could assimilate seamlessly into American society. I had the right class background, I recognize that. I thought I'd watch the right movies, listen to the right music, enjoy my pizza and burgers, and I was going to fit right in. And maybe I would have as well, except that right very soon after I arrived, 9/11 happened. And now in 2021, as we're unwinding the forever wars, it's kind of hard for us to remember the level of fear and paranoia that gripped people in 2001 after 9/11. And I remember walking in the streets and sort of people looking at me askance and sort of stepping away from me. I remember being randomly selected for extra screening by the TSA. Well, it wasn't the TSA back then, but at airport security. And suddenly this feeling that I had that somehow I was different, that I was apart, that there's nothing I could do to sort of overcome that, that apartness, that difference, that feeling overwhelmed me. And I suppose for people of color who've grown up in the US, that's a very familiar feeling. For me, back then it was a very new feeling. And my impulse was to try harder to overcome it. I will try even harder to be American. I will try harder to fit in. And it was in that mindset that I encountered Frantz Fanon's Black Skin, White Masks. And I joke about it with my students now, but it was as though Fanon's hand came out from the book and throat punched me. And, you know, I don't know if you read it, Jeff, but the first few chapters, I mean, I was reading it and I thought to myself, this is me, this is me, this is me. It was almost as if my eyes could not keep up with how fast my understanding of the text was moving. But for precisely that reason, it felt very close to me. It stuck to my skin. And I couldn't say anything about it. I could only accept it. Now, intellectually, I also sort of go back to the motivation of the book. I come back to grad school, this time at the University of Florida, and over a summer course where I decide to read everything by Arendt, but this time in a sequential fashion. I start with Love in St. Augustine, which, you know, again, you know, lovely book. I learn a lot from it. And then to my surprise, I find Rahel Van-Ha, a book that I had not thought existed in Arendt's sort of universe of concerns. And everything that I thought I saw in Fanon, I found in Arendt's book. But this time, everything but slower and deeper. And I felt the heaviness of the book. I think I mentioned in my book, one of the reviewers of Arendt's, Rahel Van Hagen, who talks about that Arendt makes you feel the burden of this woman's life. And suddenly I found this theme in this book, the theme of shame, that I was like, yeah, I see that. I could see that because I had read Fanon, I suppose, and I'd lived the life that I had lived. And then from there, I go to the Jewish writings. And from there, I go to Origins, which I know we'll talk about later. But and suddenly this theme emerges, a theme that I would, again, never have associated with art, the theme of shame and how it affects our lives. And for me, the motivation became less about explicating Arendt's understanding of shame, but more about how her concern with shame sort of speaks to some universal concerns with politics that class her not as a unique thinker. I'm very happy to appreciate Arendt as the unique thinker she is in the history of political thought with a unique conception of action, but Arendt as a thinker who can be situated alongside other anti-colonial thinkers or other post-colonial thinkers, that in these texts, the concerns that she brings intellectually and politically are closer to those thinkers. And for me, it was less her uniqueness that mattered, and more how she could be brought in part of this, brought into a larger conversation. And part of what the book is trying to do is, through the category of worldly shame, situate Arendt in that larger conversation.
That's great. I too like starting with this question because I'm often interested to see how biographical authors go and how just sort of scholarly / intellectual they go. And so you wove together this strands quite well, Manu. Thank you. So let's jump in about, you know, on the title of the book is called Worldly Shame. So I want to start with the notion of shame in the title, which is the topic of the book, of course. And I thought maybe we could start by, because the book itself and the preface, you talk about the present and shame and shamelessness as it appears in the present. And you begin by indeed characterizing our age, part by referring to a speech by Barack Obama as an age of shamelessness in some ways. See neo-Nazis marching in the street, for example. You think this would happen yet again in American life, but yet it did. The loss of shame in some sense is something regrettable, right? In that sense, that shamelessness is something bad. But you also point out at the beginning of the book that shame has been used as a weapon to, you know, oppress minorities, for example. I mean, this is a classic weapon to, you know, hold down anybody who looks or acts differently than the majority. And so in that way, you know, the loss of shame might be celebrated. So there's a kind of double-sidedness to the notion of shame in your treatment. And I just thought you could start out by just saying a little bit about how, you know, is shame a good thing or a bad thing on your view?
Yeah, you know, this is the question that really bothers me quite a bit, because I want to say that there is a good shame. The shame that I have identified, the shame I have elaborated is the good shame, and the shame that my political opponents or even my political enemies use is a bad shame. But, you know, I I think I want to move away from this idea of good and bad shame. And I think that there are important reasons for doing that. For one, I'm trying to avoid as much as I can moralizing about politics. I think sometimes when we talk about good and bad shames, we end up sort of treating politics as a moral question. And while people do make moralistic arguments within politics, you know, they accuse their opponents of lacking shame, I do not think that that's necessarily a good way of thinking about a political theory of shame. I'm also inclined to not think of shame in these terms because, and here I'm following Jill Locke's excellent book, Democracy and the Death of Shame, because I think what Jill shows very well is that the impulse we often have, you know, the impulse that says that we today have lost a sense of shame that in early ages we had in abundance and that our current lack of shame explains our political woes, that impulse is a kind of conservative lament for an earlier politics. And even when it's expressed in good faith, and you mentioned Ike Start with Obama speaking about the lack of shame when he's giving a speech at Nelson Mandela's birth anniversary, even when political actors who we respect generally and whose thoughtfulness we appreciate, when they invoke that earlier shame, they often forget the ways in which shame worked as a barrier that regulated who could participate in politics. So I think, as Jill shows very persuasively in her book, thinking about shame in these ways is not productive of a politics that invites participation. And finally, I want to think about shame in ways that are not caught up in the good and bad paradigm. And the reason for doing that is because the strategic purchase, as I said earlier, that we might get from invoking shame is really not as great as we think it is. Shame in sort of political warfare is a neutral weapon. You know, I think that my shame is good. My enemy thinks that his shame is good. I'm scandalized when someone that I think has absolutely no shame says that we should be, that, you know, America should be ashamed of how they're laughing at us or something of that sort without naming any names. I'm scandalized, but how can this person invoke shame when their life shows a certain shamelessness? But that is really about the malleability of shame that can be used by both sides. I think if I was to offer a distinction, it would be something along the lines of the following. You know, instead of thinking good and bad shames, I would ask us to make a distinction of the sort we make when we think of someone as having good judgment and when we say that someone is judgmental. Those are not opposites. They're different experiences altogether. And I think there are forms of shame that are worldly, that draw us into the world, and other forms of shame that pull us away from the world, that pull us into our interiority, into loneliness. And I think tracking the nature of that shame, which I think is really the same form, there's two sides of it, I think that is something that I want to take up, or I do take up in the book itself.
Yeah, good. I mean, I want to start talking about Hannah Arendt because I think she is quite a great resource for thinking about this notion of shame that you want to employ. Because the book is really a book about Arendt's conception of shame. What you or maybe her, does she use this term worldly shame? Is that?
No, she doesn't.
Or is that okay? So sounds like something that she would say. So that's fair. We could just start by just walking us through sort of the other word in your title, which is the worldly character of shame. You know, this term worldliness is extremely important for Hannah Arendt and for you indeed. You spend a lot of time talking about, you know, the worldliness and how this sort of carves out a distinctive kind of notion of shame that we'd be open to worldliness. So what is worldliness and how can shame be worldly?
All right, that's a great question. This is, you know, I think this is sort of the question that I think I was able to answer last in the writing of the book. After I'd figured everything out that I wanted to say, I wanted to figure out, well, what does this mean? And worldly shame is what I sort of came up with. I don't know if you remember a little while ago when I mentioned my first interaction with Arendt, I said that I wish I had read her more carefully. And what I meant was that there was a particular passage in The Human Condition that explicitly raises the questions that I'm interested in, even though Arendt herself does not really go very far in that book in answering it. And it took me going back to Rahel Van Hagen and Jewish writings and origins to basically kind of reconstruct that concern and a potential answer to it. And the passage in question is about how we become attuned to worldliness, when the tendency of, I think, what Arendt calls modern world alienation is, I think she says, it's a twofold flight from the earth into the universe and from the world into the self. I think for me, the interesting question was, well, what is the role of shame in pushing us into away from the world into the self? And how does, in Arendt's writings, shame operate or does not in helping us bring us back, bring the self back into the world? Now, Arendt, just to be clear, never theorizes shame in any way that would be familiar to her readers. It's not action, it's not work, labor, thinking, willing, judging, and all of the other concepts that we associate with her. But at some level, if the world and bringing the self back to the world, either from the universe or from the interiority of the self, is her concern, then I think shame has a very important role to play in it. More generally, to start with the concept of world, I think I'm relying largely on Heidegger and Arendt to develop our concept of worldliness, but not just them. I think, as I said earlier, I also think that Arendt can be fruitfully situated within a tradition of anti-colonial or post-colonial thought in the context of these early writings. And so to some extent, I also rely on Edward Said's conception of worldliness as a supplement to the version that I get from Arendt and Heidegger. But more generally, I think of worldliness as an orientation towards sustaining political structures that give shape to our experience of plurality and allow for the display of natality, those two terms that are very important to Arendt's political theory. When we are worldly, I think we are attuned to these structures and try to make them open to a plurality of viewpoints and voices. And this is one of the main ways in which politics is supposed to bring us back from the flight into the self. And so this is where shame comes in for me. When we experience worldly shame, we are attuned to the world around us, but in a way that makes us receptive to those plural viewpoints and in a manner that empowers us to transform the world for the better. Now, I don't know if shame can bring us back from the universe into the world, but I think it can draw the self out from its concern with interiority into a shared common world where there are a plurality of viewpoints. For one, I think shame can counteract a tendency that thinkers such as Wendy Brown, and also most recently, Sarah Rushing, who's on your program, identify as part of the neoliberal worldview, which is the desire to develop a sense of sovereignty that functions at odds with the interests of others. I think shame sort of, it makes us feel powerless in some ways, and it teaches us the lessons of powerlessness and what we can gain from that. I think in that sense, worldly shame attunes us to the fact that we are not sort of the sole creations of our own agency, but are embedded in larger networks that enable our agency. I think shame is also related to the capacity to act. And this is a very unusual understanding of shame that I sort of try and work out through Arendt's Jewish writings, especially her writings as a journalist and a publicist, I think she called herself. Shame, I think, can expand our sense of the communities within which we are embedded and practice a kind of solidarity towards them. And finally, if I'm moralizing it all in this book, it is probably on this point that worldly shame can also make us aware of the history of the world in a way that lets us take on the responsibility for the world. And this is the side of worldliness and shame that I think knits together someone like Edward Said and Arendt closer, more closely than is typical. So when we experience shame at historical traumas, we can sense the need for a space where such issues might become addressable. Now, one final point, as you can imagine, I keep using this word shame, and I learned fairly early on in this project that different people will think different things about what shame means to them. And in fact, I remember a very early conversation that I had with Jill Locke, where she basically said to me, look, you know, you will never satisfy anyone with your definition of shame. And I think definitions can sometimes become problematic because, and I think Bonnie Honig said this in conversation with you on this program for her book, Public Things, that definitions often invite contestation. And for my part, I was happy to take on board other people's definitions of shame. And in place of precision in trying to define shame in a particularly new way, I was more interested in figuring out what worldly shame does. How does it bring us out from our concern with interiority into relation with the structures that enable plurality and natality? And the chapters in the book are an attempt to use Arendt to flesh this out.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, it occurred to me as you were talking to thinking when you're talking about worldliness in terms of Hannah Arendt, this isn't worldliness in terms of a sort of cosmopolitanism, right? And then that got me thinking that, you know, there's sort of an interesting connection here with, you know, the way in which political theorists talk a lot about these days about cosmopolitanism versus nationalism and that kind of dispute. And this is possibly, I don't know what you make of this, but this has just occurred to me. It's this sort of way in which Arendt could be, you know, an alternative to these two camps, because often you think of, you know, the cosmopolitan perspective is that perspective that's beyond shame, right? Because we're beyond these, right, you know, mere local orders and have a comprehensive kind of Kantian moral perspective. Whereas the nationalism is the, you know, it's the perspective of the employment of shame in order to, you know, maintain some kind of sense of national identity. Whereas Arendt's conception of worldliness, I think, has, you know, mediates between, you could say, those two different perspectives in an interesting way, which might allow for tuning maybe shame in the right way, the golden mean, I guess, between shamelessness and shame. I don't know if you want to use that Aristotelian, but, you know, between shamelessness and too much shame and nationalism. I don't know if any of that sort of resonates with what you're up to. What do you think?
Right. No, I think that's a fascinating question. And, you know, one of the things that I'm sort of thinking about is how, at some level, depending on where you start with reading Hannah Arendt, and maybe where Arendt herself wanted to be, you know, read from, the answer to the question is very clear. She, you know, is in the mold of a student of Heidegger, and she thinks of politics as occurring within a delimited space within the polis, and therefore to think in, you know, to think in the expansive terms of cosmopolitanism is kind of a mistaken enterprise within that, the context of Arendt's political thought, mature political thought. And yet, I think one of the things I found was that there were moments in her writing during the Second World War, and maybe even after it, where she imagines a world built around federations. So she imagines a North Atlantic federation of states, which are delimited. Of course, you know, they are boundaries which will award or not award, will guarantee rights for their citizens, but also are not so tightly wound up in the project of national sovereignty as the states in Europe had been. That, you know, a tragic outcome that sort of crystallized into the Holocaust eventually. So Arendt in these early texts allows for this kind of movement between particularity and universality. And shame allows for a certain kind of traffic between those two things, but shame at the right kind of stuff, not shame about, you know, like nationalistic shame or shame about, you know, you wouldn't believe every time I go to foreign conferences, they're laughing at us, people, they're laughing at us. Again, without naming any names, you know, we can probably guess who I'm referring to. That's also a certain kind of shame, a nationalistic shame that I don't think Arendt has any patience for, but a different kind of shame that says, look, one of the things that really struck me in the Jewish writings was at one point Arendt says that the Jewish people should imagine their struggle as part of the revolutionary peoples of Asia. And so suddenly she's imagining the shame, the national shame, a Jewish person might feel in Europe as connected to the shame of being colonized somewhere else in Asia. And that common shame, that commonality can perhaps provide the basis for a federal society, a federated world. I don't know if I've answered your question well, but certainly this, I hadn't thought about it in that sense. So thank you for that question. It was very general.
I find that helpful. And in thinking about the sort of institutions that might map onto Arendt's conception here too, that's really helpful. Yeah, I wanted to talk about your chapter on Rahel von Varnhagen, which is your chapter two, that is in part because I found it very useful in sort of making some of these abstract notions very concrete, because you argue that that book of Arendt's sort of exemplifies this conception of shame that Arendt is trying to, the Arendtian conception of shame, we'll say it in that way, that you're developing here. But not only that, you know, this chapter also is a kind of way in which you describe the development of that kind of shame out of, you know, a more, let's say in terms of a more deficient conception of shame that Varnhagen herself experienced earlier on in her life in the form of anti-Semitism. So maybe you could just talk through that, you know, Arendt's biography of Varnhagen's and tell us a little bit about how, in your view, it describes this development from, I think, what you call sort of a shame aversion to a receptivity to shame. How does that work? Yeah.
Yeah, no, so actually, so thank you. That's a really helpful way of sort of framing that chapter. I think one of the things that I wanted to avoid and that I was acutely aware of as I was thinking about and writing this chapter is that the transformative capacities within shame that I want to say will draw us from the self into the world, I was aware that they should arise from within shame itself. So what I mean to say is that I did not want to do that, you know, do the work of carefully mapping out how shame disables our participation in the world, which of course it does. That's why, you know, it's such a dangerous weapon, especially when wielded by people who want to use it to bully and silence people. But I didn't want to do the work of mapping out how shame disables our participation in the world, how shame can be world destroying, and then present a different kind of shame, a good shame, as it were, that swoops down from out yonder and saves the day. And I follow Eve Sedgwick in identifying the capacity within shame aversion that becomes more receptive to the world by calling it a kind of shame proneness. So from a purely textual perspective, this shame proneness is latent within shame aversion. Now, that's kind of the claim that I'm trying to make. And in Rahel's life, as Arendt reconstructs it, shame is experienced as a lifelong desire to somehow distinguish herself from others. But the form that this distinction takes is dictated by the society in which Rahel is enmeshed. There is no possibility for a Jewish woman living in a largely authoritarian society in 19th century Berlin to seek distinction in the forms that are available to men, for example. For Rahel, instead, it meant trying to cultivate friendships with the right sorts of people, trying to marry the right sort of man, you know, whatever would sort of allow her, anything that would allow her to rescue herself from what she experiences as the shame of being Jewish and the loneliness this generates for her. And only in this way, in the way that Arendt is constructing the story, can Rahel create distance between herself and her Jewish background. And this is the kind of shame that I call shame aversion, which is to say, and this is not particularly novel here, this is the basic psychoanalytical insight, that Rahel wants to avoid her experience of shame. And her entire life plan is oriented around the search for a path that will save her from it. Now, shame proneness, I argue, is sort of already latent in shame aversion. Now, from a strictly textual perspective, this is, again, I'm not making any general claim about how the two are linked, but purely in how Arendt constructs the story of Rahel's life, the path that Arendt charts for Rahel is one that travels from shame aversion to proneness. So in her final years, after finally achieving everything her younger self may have desired, and after having basically, you know, quote unquote, arrived into the sphere into which she had always sought entry, finally, Rahel realizes that maybe this was not what she had wanted, that this would not give her the happiness she yearned for. And what gives her particular pause is the fact that her own distant, poorer relatives start to behave in an obsequious manner around her. And before these people, she feels ashamed. Now, this is the word, I'm not me assigning the words to Arendt, to Rahel. This is Arendt saying, this is what Rahel feels. Rahel felt ashamed. I mean, this is a massive transformation. In the past, she would have felt shame in front of people whose acceptance she wanted. And in the process, and given the particularities of the process of assimilation, this would have meant distancing herself from her fellow co-religionists, as Arendt calls them. But now she's feeling shame in front of precisely those people from whom she had sought distance. And what this means is, first of all, is that shame does not disappear from her life. She does not move from a life lived with shame to one without it. And the book, I think Rahel Varnhagen, is no Bildungsroman in that sense. There is no moral education that is happening that is total and transformative. Rahel never becomes, in Arendt's eyes, a conscious pariah. This is the fabled actor that in George Cator's wonderful phrasing is someone who would not accept acceptance except on his own terms and would fight politically to secure those terms. Rahel does not become that. What happens instead is that she learns to understand that the narrative arc of her life need not be dictated solely by her shame before one sort of people, which had been for much of her life the high society people whose ranks she had wished to join. She learns instead to feel shame before a diverse group of people. And this in turn allows her to experience her affinity with a multiplicity of perspectives. So it is not that she expunges shame from her life, it is that she learns to learn its lessons in a way. She learns the powerlessness that comes from being overwhelmed by shame. Now, I want to make one final point regarding this, because and I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole because I know who I'm speaking to. I know you're very, I know your expertise in Nietzsche and Rousseau, so I want to be very careful in what I say. But I do not think that I know how one can learn to give up shame. For instance, like, you know, so I think it would be a wonderful story if at one, for much of our life we felt shame aversion, and then suddenly some transformation happened in us and we learned to give up our shame. I think what happens most likely to most of us is that we substitute, as life goes along, the people in front of whom we feel shame. I no longer feel shame in front of my childhood friends because their perspective does not matter to me as much as it did when I was a teenager. I'm more inclined to feel ashamed in front of my professional peers because theirs is a society that I wish to join. But even that is changing. I mentioned to you earlier that I've recently become a father. And I think the perspective that suddenly matters the most to me is that of my daughter. I want her to think well of me. I mean, the point is that I do not think the transformations over my life indicate the transformation in my capacity to feel shame. I am, as, and this is the part that I'm very, very careful about, I'm, as Rousseau might say, a creature riven through and through with amour propre. In fact, I think the Rousseauian point is that all of us are in some sense creatures who are built in that way. I think the point that I make in this book is that the idea that there is a true self that is immune from the perspective of others is a fiction. Donald Winnicott and Jessica Benjamin, whose work I rely on to make this point, but also I think Judith Butler, basically make the case that our sense of self is forever attendant upon the circumstances in which we are enmeshed. Our incompleteness never allows us to escape the need for others. And I think at one point, Butler makes this point in a way that really appealed to me. I think it was in her Psychic Life of Power, and she's talking about the master-slave dialectic. And she says that we would sooner attach to sites of pain than not attach at all. And so I'm interested in knowing how to make this independence of mind and character that can somehow occur without shame happen. I don't think it can. I think for most of us, that's not a possibility. And for me as an immigrant, for Rahel as a Jewish woman, and I imagine, I think for many others who have not been blessed by fate, the path towards independence of some sort of independence of mind and character, I think is through relationality. And I think shame doesn't go away in that. I think shame stays throughout.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that the connection with Rousseau, and indeed, I think with Hegel is really a nice one and occurred to me as I was reading your book, because certainly, I mean, I would describe the, well, first of all, just to back up, I mean, I think I'm very much sympathetic to your view that the way to think about, you know, shame and versus, you know, good versus bad forms of shame is not to think of them as ideal types, and as it were, you're like applying an ideal form to the empirical world, but to think about them in terms of kind of psychological and sociological development. And so, I mean, you've given sort of Arendt's, you know, mini view in the form of this biography, and indeed, it seems to me to resonate well with, you know, the form of that Rousseauan tradition where Rousseau begins to think about how amour propre, desire for recognition, develops in human history, and how it has a kind of teleological direction. At least this is my view, so controversial, but you know, you can see it more clearly, I think, in Hegel, that this desire for recognition has a teleological direction and can only come to some kind of satisfaction in conditions of equality. And I take it that's roughly what Arendt is arguing here, right? That shame itself, that we're all open to shame, and shame is inescapable, but we can never be fully satisfied in kind of the unequal conditions of shame, that we need to be, that it's only in conditions of plurality and natality and in which, you know, the shame proneness is actually satisfying to us rather than sort of causing us grief. Is that right?
So I think, you know, there's a way in which the polis as the place of isagoria and isonomia sort of solves for us the problem of social inequality and allows us to appear as, you know, as who we are as opposed to what we are in the space of politics. And this is why I think, you know, to think of Arendt and shame together is so unusual a project, because if you start from the human condition, then recognition has no role to play in politics. There is nothing beyond the mask of the actor, the voice that sounds through the persona, that's all that matters. And then, yes, you can have that experience and take it back to the private realm and reflect on what that means and its significance for you, but politically, that is not important. I'm not against that view. I appreciate that view, but to me, then that way of thinking about politics suddenly becomes detached from what I think of as politics and what I think are the concerns that motivate people to go into politics and think about it in a systematic way. And I think, you know, certainly in Rehelvenhagen, certainly in Jewish writing, certainly in Origins, this concern for recognition is Arendt diagnoses it for the most part as being completely misdirected for much of, you know, the 19th century history in Europe, and hopes, as in the few ways that she gestures into the future, that it might find its resolution in something else, in something that's more global rather than hierarchical. So sort of the plane spreads out across countries, across peoples, rather than sort of being wedded to the hierarchical ranks of, you know, European aristocracies in the way that it had been during the 19th and 20th centuries.
I wanted to turn, I mean, this is a good transition, I think, to turn to, you know, how shame can be a kind of, can facilitate democratic political life. Mm-hmm. Because the connection, you know, I mean, the second chapter on Rehelvenhagen, I think, you know, sort of it explicates your view of shame, the Arendtian conception of shame at the, you know, interpersonal level, one might say. But then in chapter three, you sort of bring out the, you know, the democratic potential of shame and how it can facilitate a form of solidarity, even. I was wondering if you could kind of talk through that, because, you know, one of the concerns I had in the back of my mind in reading this chapter about the way in which shame can be a facilitator for democracy was, you know, I guess, you know, good old-fashioned liberal concerns about how, you know, shame might be a inhibitor to freedom of thought and expression, right? So I'm thinking of, you know, say somebody like Tocqueville's concerns about the tyranny of the majority over thought, that in the democracy we're really susceptible to the will of the majority who can shame us. And so nonconformity, you know, requires sort of a cultivation of just an ability to overcome that feeling of shame. Mm-hmm. So you could talk about how in your view, you know, sort of this Arendtian notion of shame can facilitate democracy and maybe sort of avoid some of those liberal criticisms.
Sure. I think I'll try and answer it. I'm not sure if I would have a good answer to the question, because I think it's a, you know, what you've asked is a very significant challenge. I think if I was to try and approach an answer, I would approach it explaining what I think I was trying to do in that chapter. And then sort of from there, drawing out possible connections to democracy and to the challenge that I think rightfully a liberal conception of nonconformity would present to, you know, a votary of shame, as I'm making myself out to be. So I think there were two things that I was trying to do in this chapter, and I was trying to link them together. The first has to do with the relationship between shame and action, and the second has to do between shame and solidarity. But I think they're of a piece in Arendt's writings during the Second World War and offer an interesting insight into what shame can do in democratic life. So let me start with the first, shame and paralysis. So we typically think of shame as paralyzing us in some way. And I think that's right. I think one of my concerns was, if I'm trying to think of shame as an attunement into politics, then is not the ethos in action, as the subtitle, the text of the book, can this ethos ever transform itself into any kind of action? Are we not going to be just sort of struck dumb and paralyzed by what we experience when we experience shame. And I think I rely on Agamben here to make the claim that in shame, we are deconstituted and reconstituted as a subject. So the way this works is that when we experience shame, our sense of self is disturbed in some fashion. We thought we were one way, then shame overwhelms us, and now we realize that we are not that. This is the deconstituting side of shame. In cases where shame is used to dominate people, the reconstitution is often as a tarnished identity. I mean, this is in one sense what Du Bois experiences in The Souls of Black Folk, when as a young man, or as a young child actually, a girl who is new to his town refuses to accept a card from him. And I remember the quote sort of, it goes like, I know it dawned on me that, you know, I was different from others, alike maybe in how I felt, but sort of separated by a vast, from their world by a vast veil. I think it's something like that. And that's the reconstitution, right? He's been reconstituted, or at least this girl tries to, by, you know, in the form of someone who is not her equal. But the reconstitution can work in a different way as well, in a way that actually allows for action. And here, sort of the example would be the Greek, ancient Greek notion of how shame functions. In the book, I refer to Achilles as Iodos Nemestos, and I apologize to you and to everyone else who could speak Greek for my pronunciation. But basically the idea is that Achilles is someone who is an actor capable of feeling shame and acting to expunge the shame. So the idea here is that, you know, if you're an Achilles, when you experience shame about something, you are told that the aristocratic notion of yourself that you thought you were, you are not. You are not measuring up to it. But within that accusation is an automatic sort of link to action. And the automatic link is, but if you do the following thing, you can now be, you can once again regain that status that you think you have lost by the experience of shame. Now, what I found was interesting in Arendt's writings during this period is that she's often doing something similar. She is deconstituting an assimilationist identity amongst her readers. Her readers were largely, I imagine, other refugees like her. Her writings in, I should clarify, for a newspaper that was published in the US called Aufbau, whose readership was German, and I think would have included other refugees and assorted emigres in living in the United States at the time. And in all of her articles, or many of her articles in Aufbau during this period, she has, the article itself is in German, but there is this little passage or epigraph at the top in English, which says, this means you. And so basically she calls her readership into attention. And she says, you should be ashamed of what's happening in Europe. There's a one article of hers that I discuss. It's, you know, it's titled Not One Kaddish Will Be Said. And she basically sort of shames her audience into realizing that their sense of self, the sense of masculine selves, the sense of, you know, Jewish selves is being violated by what is happening in Europe. At the same time, the link to action that she then presents, the way she reconstitutes their identity, is very interesting. She does not simply say, hey, if you want to be real men, go out and fight. She says, if you want to be citizens who are, you know, sort of capable of taking on the burdens of this, what our age currently is presenting to us, you will link yourself up with all these other nationalities in Europe who are experiencing shame at what is happening. You will link your shame to their shame. And in the process, you will develop this global shame almost that is capable of action. Not action along the vectors of one identity, but action along the vectors of a new identity. And this I thought was very interesting because now here you have the second part of what this chapter was trying to do, which is Arendt is basically using shame to provoke solidarity, but in a completely new way, right? We typically think of solidarity, or not typically think of it, but most people use solidarity as something that organizes itself around some pre-given identity, some notion of we that is pre-existing around which we must, you know, cohere. Whereas this, the we that Arendt is pointing her readers towards does not yet exist. But what is going on here? How is shame supposed to do that? So, you know, this led me to one of the puzzles that of reading Arendt's On Revolution, which I did not understand in its entirety at the time when I read it, which was how she described solidarity. And I think she says solidarity is something that can comprehend a multitude conceptually and eventually all mankind. And that's a very weird definition of solidarity, so far as that's a definition, to comprehend a multitude conceptually. And I think what she's doing here, the way she's using shame, and I invite the listeners to read the book and see how I track its uses in her writings at the time, is that she's using shame both to connect the struggles of Jewish people in Europe to the struggles of occupied nations in Europe and revolutionary peoples in the rest of the world. At the same time, she's also sort of pointing to the uniqueness of the Jewish experience. So there's an interesting sort of connection and separation that's happening at the same time, which, you know, I think somewhere in the human condition, she describes the world as like a table. We are both connected and separated by our particular experiences. I think shame operates in that way for Arendt in these writings. And so shame, you know, to come back to your question, Jeff, about the challenge of nonconformity, I don't think shame in the way that Arendt is using it is provoking conformity. It is provoking connection. It is asking people to think of their struggles as not their own individual sort of experiences, but as part of larger historical forces that are at work in which they are unwitting actors, and to take control and, you know, try and change their destiny. But at the same time, she's not saying that you have to be defined by it. That she, at one point, she says each nation will, you know, have its own reckoning with its own role in what has transpired in Europe, which means that shame can be specific enough to be felt, but, you know, in its particularity, but also in its generality. And I think that traffic between the two might answer something of the concern with nonconformity that I think you rightly point out, you know, must attend any discussion of shame.
Yeah, that's good. We might go back to that in a minute, but I wanted to talk just a little bit more about this notion of solidarity, because I find this fascinating, the idea that you're trying to develop here about connecting, you know, that solidarity can sort of emerge out of, you know, a common experience of shame. Because in a way, I don't know much about the scholarship here, but, you know, the sort of lay understanding of solidarity, you know, solidarity would emerge from kind of common experiences of pain and suffering and oppression or whatever. You know, workers of the world are uniting because they're exploited or whatever. So that's, you know, so solidarity is a path via kind of common forms of oppression. But so this, the Arendtian view is not that, though. It's a kind of common experience of shame. I find that interesting, especially in the context. I mean, I can understand in the context of, say, Germany after World War II, right? We'll talk about that in a minute, and the origins of totalitarianism and whatnot. But if you're talking about, you know, say the Jewish people, you know, who have been historically oppressed, and you might think that it's the oppression that's leading to them to the solidarity rather than the shame. I guess I'm trying, I guess I just want to push you a little bit more and maybe saying a little bit about, you know, shame is a notion about, I guess, you know, failing to live up to some, you know, higher sense of self or higher identity that we're not quite achieving. So what is that, I guess? What are we failing to do in those kinds of circumstances that can lead us to a kind of common solidarity?
Right. So I think one of the, this is a great question, Jeff. And I will try to answer it to the degree that I can, but I fully recognize that I may not have a good answer to your question. So, and something that I have to think through more, and, you know, but one of the ways in which sort of the word solidarity, I think the roots of it are keeping safe, but also one of the roots of it is common ownership. And I think what Arendt is saying in that sense of the word solidarity is that we must all take common ownership of what the world has become. The world in 1945 that we're inheriting, why it has come to be this way. You will not, Arendt thinks, capture the true story of how the world ended up by tracing only one line of experience, which is your particular suffering. That will only show you a partial picture, and therefore the solution that you will draw from it will also therefore be partial. You must try to think of the world in its broader historical contours. And I think that's why I think the sheer scope of what she attempts in Origins is amazing. Whether she gets it right or not, and lots of people criticize her, I think rightly, for at the very least, her very insensitive language in the section on imperialism, possibly, you know, her outright racism. But the sheer breadth of what she attempts in that book is an attempt to think through the world in common, the world in common as it has become in 1945. And in that sense, I think the self, the solidarity that she's asking people to create is not an identity-based solidarity that is built around, this is my suffering, this is, you know, a wounded attachment, to use Wendy Brown's phrase, that people would sort of cohere around. Nor is she sort of, and I must thank George Maher for his review of Robin Marasco's very amazing book, for drawing this contrast. Nor is she asking people to imagine sort of the cruel optimism of a future, which will never be realized. She's asking people to take stock of where they are. And I think shame operates in a way by paralyzing us in terms of the meaning we can give to our experience. It says, this is the meaning of who you are. When someone shames you, you are, okay, you know, we are on this is a voice-based medium, but if your listeners Google me, they will see that I'm bald. So if someone says to me, you are a bald man and this is who you are, I'm paralyzed by that experience because the experience, it doesn't allow me to make any other meaning out of my lack of, you know, hair on my head. This is a very trivial example. I apologize. I could not think of a better one in this moment, but that's a very regular feeling of shame for me nowadays. Embarrassment, not shame. But I think what Arendt is trying to ask us to do is think of the present as something that is neither sort of drawn to wounded attachments of the past, I've lost my hair, not to cruel optimism where I'll get a wig or hair implants and I will look so much better, but take stock of the fact that yes, I'm bald and this is the world that as it actually exists. What can I do with it? Again, a very trivial example, I apologize for that, but that sense of groundedness of being in our body, of acknowledging where we are and from where we are beginning, I think that's important to Arendt. And I think it's a valuable goal.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I find it interesting in part because I've been working on Kant now for, you know, a year or two. And, you know, he has a sort of conception of the moral law as a way in which he's sort of humiliated mm-hmm. in front of the moral law. We should not be humiliated in the face of other people,
sure, yeah.
But we should only be humiliated in front of the moral law, which is an interesting sort of departure from, I know Arendt, you know, tries to recover the sort of the critique of judgment version of Kant, mm-hmm. but here, you know, he has a sort of, you know, the you know, maybe not a worldly conception in that sense, and in the way in which Kant sort of looks toward, you know, has an optimism for the future, a hope for the future, and not a kind of take stock. So it's an interesting, I think, contrast with some of these figures, because I think a lot of these figures in that tradition, Rousseauan tradition, are trying to figure out how to, you know, that this is a really fundamental or basic human emotion that's relevant to politics, and we need to think about how to deal with it.
Yeah.
So good. I wanted to talk about chapter four because this is, you know, in your final chapter talks about the origins of totalitarianism, which you alluded to a moment ago. I didn't know found it fascinating that she was going to, was it either going to be entitled or subtitled The Elements of Shame? What was it?
I think it was the title.
It was going to be the title, which is pretty amazing. I mean, it also really sort of relevant for your thesis of your book. So, I mean, I thought you could talk through, I mean, how you see your thesis playing out in the book Origins of Totalitarianism, you know, what the significance of this alternative title that wasn't to be The Elements of Shame, you know, helps us understand that book maybe a little bit differently, because it's, you know, I mean, it's a book probably all of us know, and we can certainly see the connection with shame in the sense that it's about sort of the horrors of the 20th century and how nations can come to terms with those horrors. But yeah. So how does seeing shame, looking at that book through the lens of shame, help us think about it differently?
Yeah. So this is one of those things when I was a grad student, you know, and I was first working on this project for my dissertation, I thought to myself, this is great. Shame is the riddle of Hannah Arendt solved. But, you know, it would have been fantastic if she had named it Elements of Shame, and then I guess my book would not have been important then. It would have been very clear. As it turns out, she wasn't happy with that title either. She was not happy with any of the titles, including Origins, which was not her choice. We learned this from Elizabeth Young Brule's biography. The title Origins was suggested to her by her editor, who thought, you know, it could be something like the origins of the species kind of argument. And so, you know, some people have done a very good job of it, have tried to figure out, well, what is this process of crystallization? What is is it a teleological argument? Is it, you know, is it a naturalist argument? People have tried to figure it out. In Britain, it was published with a different title altogether. It was called The Burden of Our Times, which is a very different title from Origins, and perhaps in some ways closer to the Elements of Shame title that I'm interested in. What I tried to show in this chapter was that for Arendt, shame was the only emotion that we could rightfully feel when we encountered what had transpired in the Holocaust. Her chapter on total domination towards the end of Origins basically maps out what was done legally, morally, and of course physically to the inmates of the concentration camps. They were reduced to bundles of reaction and deprived of all spontaneity that makes them, you know, human being. And I think, again, it was Agamben who draws attention to Arendt's own reaction to this. There's an interview of hers, I think it's called What Remains, you know, the Language Remains. It's an interview with Günter Gauss. And Arendt starts to tell how it was that she first learned about what had transpired in the camps. And she says, you know, we didn't believe it when it was coming in. My husband is something of a military historian, and he said this entire idea is nonsense. The Germans would never do that. It's a complete waste of resources. And then they find out that it's true. And she says, you know, then I found out everything, you know, about the fabrication of bodies. And then she stops and she hurries over the details of what actually transpired. And Agamben says, like, looking at this interview, he says, look, Arendt herself is overcome with a reflux of shame. So Adriana Cavarero has this amazing book called Horrorism. And she says, you know, what happened in the camps was an attack on the ontological dignity of human beings. The horror of what happened there transcends our moral categories and standards of jurisdiction. Now, it seems to me that moral categories and standards of jurisdiction are exactly what are at play when we are interested in thinking about guilt. And this Arendt thought was impossible, because when it came to the Holocaust, we would not be able to quite pin down exactly how to capture what had happened. I think her teacher and friend Karl Jaspers wrote a book, The Question Concerning German Guilt, and he basically had a fourfold conception of guilt: criminal, political, moral, and metaphysical. And Arendt says, look, you don't want to use guilt in that sense. You know, guilt is specific. Guilt is tied to acts. Guilt is tied to what was done. And that is important, but it should be preserved for those instances where we can identify the particular actors who were involved in perpetrating these crimes. For everybody else, their judgment was warped by the fact that they were living in a criminal regime that, you know, basically made what was criminal legal. And so you had all these good old-fashioned German paterfamilias who all they were concerned with was putting food on their family's table, who, you know, were able to very easily contort their sense of right and wrong. I think she calls them table manners, to whatever the prevailing dispensation was. And so we need, Arendt thought, a different vocabulary for thinking about what this would mean. And, you know, she goes on with in Eichmann in Jerusalem, and then her writings following that, when she traces out, you know, the life of the mind and thinking, willing, and judging, in thinking about what faculty in the human mind, sort of in the vita contemplativa, can best guard us against what has happened. But in the immediate aftermath of this experience, the moment when she learns about what has happened, the moment when she's reckoning with what has happened in its, you know, temporal proximity, I think in those moments she thinks about shame. And what she calls this shame is an elemental shame that has that's all that's left after we discover what has happened, when, you know, the ontological dignity of human beings has been completely destroyed. We are left with something that is as basic as the shame of being a human being. And from that recognition, from that recognition of that shame, we can actually build something. I think, if I'm remembering this correctly, I think it was the interview with Günter Gauss where, you know, she's sort of talking about her former friends, and she says, look, you know, mistakes were made. If people at least acknowledge what happened, we can talk. But for those who do not feel any shame, who do not even acknowledge there's something to be felt, you know, to feel shame about, those people don't exist for me. She doesn't say this exactly, but I think, you know, she refers to in the Bible what Jesus calls the scandalon, something that should never have existed, should have a millstone placed around its neck and be made to disappear. She says, that's my feeling about that kind of stuff. But those who experience shame, at least we can talk about it. And I think from a purely philosophical perspective, I quite like this idea, because I'm inclined to go with someone like Bernard Williams, who says that, you know, guilt on its own will never help us understand our relationship to the events that demand our guilt. And we will never be able to reconstruct ourselves based purely on the basis of what we are able to discharge when we are, you know, deemed guilty of something. We need something else that will allow the self to persist in the world and to, you know, reconcile itself with it. And I think there, shame allows for a kind of, and I'm drawing on Roger Berkowitz, who's a very fine interpreter of Arendt, what Roger Berkowitz calls a kind of mutual release. That in shame, I in my recognition of your shame and yours of mine, we can perhaps release ourselves of the burden of trying to figure out what you could have done and turn instead to what we can do. And I think, you know, this idea of shame then, I think, allows also for a reckoning for how the world came to be the way it is. And I mentioned much earlier that I think that there is a certain proximity, possibly, between Arendt and Edward Said. And so for Said, worldliness, the worldliness of a text, is the conditions within which a text became a text, in the conditions within which it circulated, the secular history within which all this happened. And I think Arendt, through this recognition of shame, or recognition of each other's shame, is saying, we can actually take stock of what was done, of what happened in the past. And this can be the grounds for building something. Now, I want to be very careful here, because I realize that one potentially does something deeply anti-Arendtian by saying what I just said. I am not saying in the book at any point, in fact, I'm at pains to distance myself from this, that our politics that emerges out of this experience of mutual experience or recognition of shame should be about addressing that shame. I don't think that's right. I think Arendt herself calls this elemental shame non-political. But the shame acts as a kind of boundary that draws us in and keeps us, tethered to a world in common, that escape from the world into the self. It disables that. It brings us out into the shared public world with a shared global history.
Yeah, that's great. Because it brings up this important point about guilt versus shame. And I found this, you know, your answer here and in the book about, you know, how shame can be a deeper and more encompassing reactive attitude than guilt. Is it, you know, and I appreciate Bernard Williams on this too, in the Shame and Necessity book. In some ways, shame is, you know, a lot of people think of it as, you know, an old stuffy honor culture kind of emotion, right? I mean, it's connected with, you know, the shame at failing to live up to what it is, like the Rape of Lucretia, you know, failure to live up to some, like, you know, Roman conception of femininity or something like that. Whereas guilt, you know, is often associated with the turn towards modernity and the individualization. But there's often, you know, seem to me to be, and this is maybe the Nietzsche side, the genealogy of morals, the connection between guilt and the sort of economic, you know, the merely economic return of a kind of evil. And that sort of, you know, merely commercial exchange doesn't seem to, you know, you know, I think fully capture the weight of some evils and the redemption of some evils. Whereas the shame, I mean, and it sounds to me what Arendt is doing with shame here is sort of harnessing that, you know, the connection of the honor culture and shame, and not pinning it to a particular culture, but thinking of it in terms of humanity in general, right? That we're, that, you know, there's a failure of recognition of living up to being human.
Sure.
That's there.
No, thank you for saying that. I mean, I wish I'd had this conversation with you earlier, would have made my attempt to make this case much smoother. You mentioned Nietzsche. I think I've been avoiding Nietzsche in this conversation because I keep thinking back to when I first encountered this passage in Nietzsche, and I was so disappointed. And he's, I think, I forget where he was, he says this, but it's like, he asks, what is the most humane thing? It's like, to spare someone shame. And I was like, there you go. I can't get anything out of Nietzsche from this, but I can. And this is, you know, the contrast with guilt. I wish I'd thought of it in those terms. It would have made my sort of picking the case much easier, because you're right. I think there's a certain sense in which guilt is so specific, and for precisely that reason, very, very helpful. But not sufficient for dealing with sort of the larger issues, the larger conditions that create something as horrible as the Holocaust, or in, as I argue in the book, you know, the imperialism and the crimes committed in that, and to some extent, sort of the evil that we, I mean, maybe I should not use the word evil, but certainly the forgetfulness that we allow ourselves to experience with respect to how the conditions within which we live today in the West is made possible by the continued exploitation of people elsewhere. And I think if you ask me to feel guilty about that, I doubt if I'll accept that charge. I will rebel against that. I do feel shame. And maybe, you know, there's something that draws me out of my own sort of concern with myself when I'm addressed by that shame. And maybe that has some political uses. I don't know. I would like to know what you think as well about this.
That sounds good to me. That sounds good. I wanted to be, before we close, you know, talk more kind of, you know, close with a few general questions, sure. Especially about the sort of contemporary implications of your view. But before we go to the contemporary sort of implications, you know, I wanted to ask about the Arendtian view of forgiveness, because, you know, it makes a pretty prominent appearance in The Human Condition.
Yeah.
And I just was wondering, I mean, because there might be, you know, one might conceive there to be somewhat of a tension here between, you know, Arendt's injunction to forgive and that forgiveness is an important part of the polis, whereas your view about shame and shame is an important part of the polis is, you know, are those things in tension with one another? I mean, you know, because to shame maybe means not to forgive, but to shame someone, and to be feel shamed is to feel not forgiven. Are those terms, I think, on your view, mutually exclusive, or are they, or not?
You know, I hesitate to sort of answer that question in ways that come to me first as a first thought, because I think of all the Arendtians who would be up in arms if they heard what I actually thought about this. So let me try it in a way that sort of may not aggravate them. I think that to the degree that a standard interpretation of Arendt would take exception with what I've said, it would be on precisely this question, which I'm, again, great pains to make myself clear on, is that they would interpret me as saying, Manu, are you saying that politics should be about shame? This is a place, politics is a space where we sort of work through our shames. Isn't that the very antithesis of an Arendtian project? And I would say absolutely. That you're absolutely right. That those things cannot possibly work together. You can't have Arendtian freedom, the natality, the possibility of something new emerging if you are tethered down by your shame. And in fact, at some point in the Jewish writings, Arendt actually makes the argument that in order for future generations to live freely, they must not be burdened by the shame of our inaction today. They must not carry the shame of the fact that we did not act today, and so they must now bear that shame and the consequences of that inaction, the two separate things. So on that view, I think forgiveness and shame would work in very opposite directions. I think in the kinds of actual political concerns that aren't engaged as a commentator in politics, I think their forgiveness and shame might actually come together. Because I think forgiveness and forgetfulness aren't necessarily the same thing. And I think, you know, as I said earlier with following Roger Berkowitz, who I think draws it from Arendt, the Arendt Heidegger correspondence after the war, I think this idea of mutual release, of saying, look, I acknowledge your shame, and you acknowledge mine, and let's see what we can build having acknowledged it, rather than carrying the trauma of not knowing what it is you did or did not do during this tumultuous time in our lives. I think that element, the way in which forgiveness and shame can work together by being opposed to forgetfulness or by pushing things into holes of oblivion, I think in those ways, I think action becomes possible. And so approached from that angle, I can think of those two terms in closer proximity. But again, from a standard Arendtian view or standard view of Arendt interpreters of the human condition, yeah, those two things have nothing in common and shame should be expunged from all political life altogether, which I don't know how that would happen, but sure.
So I'm curious about how Arendt might respond to some contemporary trends, certainly in the use of shame. So I'm thinking of, the use of Twitter mobs to sort of shame people online. Presumably Arendt would not be in favor of that. But I wonder why. I guess, the more general question is how would Arendt view the sort of currency of shame as it's being used in the contemporary world? Would she think it's overused, underused, used in the wrong way?
I hate this question. I hate it. Because, it's like you're asking me to put my cards on the table and basically sort of potentially come to a conclusion that is in complete opposition to everything I've said in the book. Let me put it this way. I think there is this absurd sort of model of the Twitter attack, which is laughable, if only if people didn't take it so seriously. Which is, I think, people say like, "I like chocolate chip cookies." It's like, I feel attacked for all the oatmeal cookies that you have ignored in the way in which chocolate chip has taken. I'm being again absurd here. I apologize, but there are ways in which people sort of take the absence of their concern in what somebody has said as evidence of that person's disregard for the things that matter to the person who's now injured. I think that's absurd. God forbid it has happened to me and to anybody I know, but when it happens, it's just absurd. It's like, why is anyone bothered by this? It destroys the level of discourse. And certainly, there are ways in which cancel culture today, I think that's what, one of the things people are afraid of, supposedly. I think if it were true that, shame is used to cancel people, then I would be like, yeah, I don't think I like that very much. But I don't think that's what's happening either. I think to answer your question, to the extent that Arendt would encounter these things, I think she would say that these are very bad uses of shame. Again, I don't want to say there's bad shame, but they're unworldly uses. They distract us from the structures within which common life is possible. And again, I wonder if, even though Arendt herself does it at one point in time in her own career, I think in a moment in which she's under a lot of emotional and intellectual stress and physical danger. I think for the most part, I think shame is something that operates as a kind of ethical antenna, or at least worldly shame should operate as a kind of ethical antenna that attunes us to the world. And I think to the degree that shame is helping us do that, is helping us become aware of the world, the structures that enable the world in common to continue, allow for plurality of viewpoints to emerge, allow for new things to emerge, I would be in favor of that shame operating. But I don't think it can be used as a weapon by people, because I think it would end up dominating people in some way and diminishing their experience and their desire to appear in public. And so I think shame becomes in our hands when we try to use it on other people, something nefarious. But to the extent that shame allows us an opening into politics, I think that's a good thing. But I don't know how any one person can manage to do that as a tool. I don't think it's a technique we can use in politics.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the if how you conceive of shame and shame's purpose as facilitating plurality and natality, certainly Twitter ain't that, right? I mean, Twitter is not a means for facilitating plurality, but a means of, you know, sort of facilitating homogenous pockets of opinions, yeah, right? Yeah. And in that sense, I mean, and so in that way, I mean, Arendt's conception of shame might, this Arendtian conception of shame could have a critical purchase on the use of shame as we, we see it today. And I mean, I'm still going back to it because I find useful the sort of developmental, psychological, sociological account of shame developing. I mean, I get the sense that there is a lot of dissatisfaction with this, you know, the use of shame across the internet and the, you know, across American culture these days, that you know, there's some deep dissatisfaction with that, and an effort to sort of move past to a, you know, more honest and satisfying.
Sure, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, find out, I mean, one of the things that I at least occurs to me in thinking about shame and a worthwhile use of shame is not to shame, you know, the average person on the street when they make a mistake, but shame can be a useful tool in for the average person on the street to take the rich and powerful down a peg, right? So, you know, shame could be a useful thing when CEOs, you know, take huge salaries in times of crisis, or, you know, presidents do extremely odious things, et cetera. That's a sort of, I guess more of a, you know, small d democratic way of thinking about that. Would that have some resonance with Arendt, this Arendtian conception of shame, you think, or not? Would she think about it differently?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think Arendt talks very much. Well, actually, no. Let me. I'm sorry. I had an answer in my mind, and suddenly it occurred to me, something else happened. Okay, so I'll stop with this. I'm sure Jeff Bezos would feel really bad in his $500 million yacht if I shame him in some way about the things that Amazon is doing. That's a joke. I don't think it's going to bother him very much. He's the president of the Bald Federation. I love him for it. I would never shame him. But I think, you know, there's a way in which I think Arendt helps us think about this question, which is, no, I don't know. I don't think she's fair to the people to whom she's saying this. Arendt rarely is fair to the people to whom she's writing. But she accuses actors within the model of assimilation, the Jewish model of assimilation, of trying to seek out the breadcrumbs from the tables of the rich as a way to justify their own existence and to use that to protect Jewish communities. And she says, you know, that's just the will to live. What we need, a will to live on your knees. What we need is a will to die standing tall, right? And that is the only way you can justify a full life. And so in that way, she sort of appeals to this very aristocratic notion of shame. Now, I was thinking to myself, as you were asking the question, I'm not sure if I have a coherent answer to this question, but there's a way in which Arendt would say, we don't need them. We don't need the rich or their approbation or their approval in order to construct a life for ourselves apart from them. At least that's what she thinks about in the context of philanthropy and the role it plays in Jewish emancipation in the 19th and 20th century. She's, you know, and so she's very fond of the kibbutzim that are coming up in Israel, where she says a new man has been born who, you know, through the sweat of his brow is able to win for himself what in earlier generations people would have hoped and prayed for the rich to deliver. I'm not sure if Arendt, that model of thinking about the world would map on to the Amazons of the world and the Facebooks of the world, where so much of the spaces that we have for action have already been colonized by these large firms who will try and extract in some fashion, you know, something from our labor. I'm sure after this conversation on my Facebook app or my Twitter app, I'll have all sorts of ads about, are you thinking about going to a kibbutzim? Here's a teaser. So there are ways in which that would happen. And I'm not sure what the Arendtian answer would be. I also think that at some level, the aristocratic model, you mentioned the Roman model earlier. I was thinking about the Aristotelian thing of the magnanimous man, the megalocyte, right? And one of the things about megalocyte is they don't feel shame because shame is not a virtue and you only feel the virtues. But to the extent that, the opinions of others matter, the magnanimous man only does things from the perspective or seeks approbation only from those people whose opinion matters to him. And so I don't know if Jeff Bezos would care for our opinion because we don't have the $500 million, yacht. And I don't know how effective shame would be for him, but it could be effective for us to try and construct potentially an alternative model to try and force governments to, create more stringent laws, taxing Amazon and controlling its activities. I think there shame could work to bring to call people to attention. I don't know, I've not really answered your question, but your question was so generative that I'm thinking about 500 different things now. Thanks, Jeff.
Well, yeah, it certainly is. I mean, it certainly is an emotion that is people still respond to. I mean, it is powerful in politics. I mean, we've seen it again and again in the past couple of years. And so we need, books like yours in order to help us think through it. So let me just close by saying thanks so much, Madam, for joining me again today on Political Theory Review.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.